Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
So I joined the Army on the 19th of May of 1980, and after I got process in, I was told that if you're going to be in this unit, you're going to learn stuff. And they signed me up for an Army correspondence course on map reading.
Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're starting off with the story of John Millard and one very special map.
It's a topographical map. Its scale is 1 to 50,000, and up until about 2012, everybody in the Army knew the Tenino map sheet.
Tenino is a little town in Thurston County, about 30 miles southwest of Joint Base Lewis-McChord. But it's also kind of an imaginary place. Millions of people who have never set foot there can picture Tenino's every back road, every hill, every water feature. And that's because for decades, this was the map the Army used to teach basic military map reading. When he was a private in Maryland, Millard studied a map of Tenino. And years later, when he was an officer in California, he taught soldiers using a map of Tenino. So you might think it'd be easier to learn from a map of wherever you were at the moment, but in the Army, at least, you studied Tenino. So why?
Because it's difficult. And it's the Army. So if there's a hard way to do it, we're going to find it.
What makes the map so hard? Well, first of all, Tenino has a lot of topography. There are saddles and ridges, depressions, spurs. The contour lines squiggle all over the page like a plate of spaghetti.
I would describe this area as densely vegetated, compartmented terrain.
Second, Tenino has a lot of other stuff. That means many, many tiny icons to memorize.
Is it a school? Is it a church? Is it a water mill? Is it a windmill? Is it a mine with a vertical shaft? Is it a mine with a horizontal shaft?
Finally, there's one more reason the military likes to use this particular map. For this kind of thing, the Army doesn't use latitude and longitude or GPS coordinates. They use their own special grid to match up map points to the real world. It's just one of those disconnects between military and civilian life that can make it hard to translate back and forth. And because of a quirk of Tenino's geography, you have to do some calculating to get your compass and map lines to sync up. Getting it wrong can have big consequences. At worst, death. At best, blisters. It is a tricky map. Millard retired from the Army in 2010, but he hangs on to a copy of the Tenino map sheet.
Okay, Northcraft Mountain on this map would be located at Echo Gulf.
Even if he didn't still have a copy of the map, Millard would have no trouble picturing every detail of this town. That's because, in a twist of fate, John Millard actually lives on this map. Ever since he moved to Tenino in 1999, he's gotten a kick out of telling Army friends where he lives.
The same one? Yeah, it's a real place.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is getting there. Stories of what happens on the way. Back now to John Millard and the story of how this page of symbols and coordinates suddenly became his real-life three-dimensional hometown. Sound Effect's Posey Gruner picks up the tale.
John Millard wasn't trying to move to Tenino. It just kind of ended up that way. This was back in 1999. He'd been assigned to Fort Lewis, and he and his family needed a place to live. They had some requirements. South of Fort Lewis, but within commuting distance. Above a floodplain, but not on a hill. Out in the open, so they could see who was coming. And more than one way in and out. Beyond that, the search was up to Millard's wife. And while he was away in Korea, she found it.
And I said, oh, great, where is it? And she said, it's in Tenino. I said, great, our address is going to be a grid coordinate.
He points it out on the map.
So my house would be located at Echo Gulf, 09.
It was a strange twist of fate.
So that'll get you within 100 meters. And our house is a very bright green. If you're within 100 meters of our house, you would know it.
Millard and his wife had fun with it. In the years after they moved to Tenino, they'd go on special little excursions, looking for spots that they'd only known as little icons on the map.
We'd go to the beach, and on the way back, we'd find a back road, and, you know, the Oregon Trail marker on Highway 507. There it is! We found it, you know.
They drove to other spots just to see if they were as beautiful as their names.
Violet Prairie, Cozy Valley, the lookout tower on Crawford Mountain, it's all there.
There was one spot, though, that they just couldn't find. A spot that is definitely not on civilian maps.
A machine gun bunker abandoned, and it is on the west side of the Olympia Municipal Airport.
When Army friends learned where Millard and his wife lived, they got a kick out of it, too.
Hey, this is John, and he lives in Tenino. Really?
But here's the thing. It didn't work the other way around. When Tenino residents learned that Millard was an Army veteran, nobody got any particular kick out of it. In fact, most people had no idea that Tenino was Army famous. And that is odd, because like most small towns, Tenino is just bursting with pride. They have markers to celebrate their old sandstone quarry, a museum exhibit on the town's Depression-era wooden money, a whole book about how the town got its name. But the fact that for 30 years, their town played a part in national defense, the fact that millions of Army veterans know their name, seems to Millard that most people he meets have no idea.
I've been educating them. I think most of them don't. Not that Tenino doesn't have its share of veterans. It certainly does. But by and large, you know, as a percentage of the country, veterans are really relatively small in number. So the kids don't know.
It revealed a massive gulf right in the middle of the town, one that wasn't on the map.
I don't think the vast majority of our countrymen know the value that the country gets from having people serve in uniform. And I'm not talking about shooting things and killing people and all that kind of stuff. It's about living a certain lifestyle, living a certain creed, understanding that you're part of something that's bigger than you are and that you have a role to play in it. And the kind of good that comes out of it, what the military puts back into society is people that can plan, people that can think, people that can be where they're supposed to be on time. You know, it's just all that little stuff.
But then, on Veterans Day in 2018, something special happened. Tenino was dedicating a new veterans memorial, and a 3-star Army general came over from Joint Base Lewis-McChord to help dedicate it. And he brought the city of Tenino a present.
And what he brought to us, and you're welcome to come to City Hall and see it, is a framed copy of this map along with the First Corps crest and the First Corps patch and a very nice plaque.
The Tenino map sheet now hangs in City Hall, and anyone walking by can study the map and find Violet Prairie, Cozy Valley, and the machine gun bunker abandoned. Millard is retired from the Army. He has a civilian job now as Tenino City Clerk, and he works at City Hall. Every once in a while, he sees someone walk past the map. Someone who clearly has no idea. He likes to watch as they do a double take, lean in for a closer look, and then, bing, the light bulb goes on.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today on Sound Effect is getting there. So there's this story. It's a true story, and it's also become kind of a legend, part of local lore, especially within Seattle's punk rock scene, and also the Washington State Ferries scene. It's about the time when a bunch of punk kids started a riot on the Kitsap Ferry. This was 1987, and there'd been a big punk show in Bremerton. It was the last sailing of the night. A bunch of kids who'd been at the show were on the boat, all pumped up. There were also a few off-duty cops and one very drunk woman. Things got out of hand. David Portnow was 15 at the time. He wasn't on the boat, but he heard all about it from friends.
Yeah, it was like total chaos and an all-out war and sounded awesome.
Even 30 years later, people are still telling this story. Sound Effects' Posey Gruner talked to a few of them. Here's the tale, told as they remember it.
You know, there was this punk rock show going over in Bremerton.
I believe there were some other bands, but the main two were The Accused, which was the biggest local band, and people loved to see them. And then a band from England, GBH.
Grievous Bodily Harm. I did have to look that one up.
Huge, huge punk band.
This was a big deal. And so there was just like an unusually large group of kids who were just excited beside themselves to go to this show.
And it was a fantastic show, I'll tell you that.
Had a great time, it was a great show. Everyone was doing their thing and then decided to take the ferry back and got down to the ferry terminal and everyone was still kind of partying and having a good time.
What, it was like 12:50 or something? It was the last ferry of the night.
There's a typical wait. Bunch of people got out and started drinking and smoking and, you know, playing music and having a good time.
There's these kids. I think everybody knew, kind of knew them because they were just kind of funny pranksters. And there was also this woman who a lot of people just knew her as sort of a fixture of the Bremerton Ferry.
She was inebriated and she was egging on and making fun of the punks, making fun of their hair, making fun of their clothes, and kind of drawing him into fight, not a physical fight, a kind of like a verbal and, look, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a badass. I'm much better than you kids. You kids think you're tough. You don't know what, you know, you're not tough. I'm tough.
The ferry shows up and everybody kind of gets on the ferry. Then there wasn't very many just normal passengers. It was just a bunch of rowdy punk rockers.
I think there was like 30, 35, you know, somewhere in that range.
As soon as everybody converges on the passenger deck, this conversation continues.
She kept doing something. They kept doing something. These things were small.
And it's definitely escalated to the point to where this woman is starting to undress. I think she's dancing on a table.
We were all kind of in the general area and listening to what was going on and interjecting a little bit. And,
you know, going, woohoo, you know.
Then she escalated it by flashing them. And it wasn't just a breast flash.
It was all kind of simmering. It was all kind of building, and you could kind of feel it coming to a point.
And for some reason, this kid
goes over and he pisses in a fake plant.
You know, just kind of laughing and like a little 4-year-old, first time he's, you know, letting his willy out in the woods and camping and peeing, you know.
There were Bremerton police, off-duty police on board.
You know, I personally think they had to do something.
They kind of grabbed this kid.
Pull up your pants, boy. Cuffing him. And then his buddy wanted his buddy released and, you know, let my buddy go. They cuffed both of them and then they ran out of handcuffs and then all of us started saying, well, don't just let go of the one guy, now let go of both the guys. And whole energy built up and more people got involved and
they began to chase the police officer who ran into crew's quarters.
This is where a discrepancy comes up.
Now there's two different tales. One, he was locked in an office.
Shut the door, asked the crew to lock the door.
And one, he was locked in a broom closet.
Just a random closet.
Essentially the janitor's broom closet.
This is pre-9/11, so the security is a lot less. It's just you and a lock in between this crowd.
And then there was he had kind of bleach blonde long hair. He ended up bending down, yelling into the vent of the door, you know, let him go, you know. And so they maced him in the face, and then he backed up, and his face was on fire.
So this guy's staggering around, and this guy's just through the roof, angry.
He punched the fire extinguisher hose and axe.
They grabbed the fire axe.
Got that free, got the axe, and started axing on the door.
That's when things got really scary, and I don't think a lot of people know about the fact that when that axe started coming through the door, they made the kids get down on the ground, face down, and they pulled out their guns and had them pointed at the door just in case the door flew open.
they were being the way that we already knew they were going to be towards us. So we felt threatened. And a lot of us at the time, too, were kind of outcasts in our own way, in our own schools, in our own family, in and out of our homes, because of the fact that we were piercing our ears and dyeing our hair and wearing messed up clothes and listening to scary music. So we were all struggling with a lot of different things. And then to have these authority figures we already were battling with battle us even more and go hands on. And I think we just grew tired of all of it and wanted to defend ourselves.
Back out in the main cabin, there's all sorts of shenanigans going on.
Statute of limitations up. we were essentially throwing down vending machines to make some ruckus, to maybe draw them out and, you know, let them go, let them go. We were chanting and other things, F the police, and found different things that we could knock over, pull down, and jump around like riotous maniacs.
They did about $40,000 worth of damage.
The Seattle Police Department was in full force just waiting. And you could see the lights from very far away, so they knew what was going to happen.
And I think some people that were kind of on the fringe of it that wanted to watch but didn't want to get their hands dirty were like, we're about ready to bump Doc, you guys. So wrap it up, wrap it up. So I think we all just started dispersing like cockroaches, and the lights came on, and we were like, all right, let's get back in the personal rig and look away when they went around with flashlights and down on the car deck, and picked out a couple of us to come back upstairs and take that long boat ride back.
Like, it was kind of a weird victory for the kids in a way. Like, when the story went around that weekend, you know, it was everybody's, it was hooray for us, you know? And it was amazing. I mean, I think that one single event, you know, created 1,000 punk rockers. And I know that's true because it, you know, it happened to me.
That story by Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. The voices you heard in that story were Ian Sterling, spokesperson for the Washington State Fairies, David Portnow, who runs Pig Records, Chris Looney, who made an animated film about the riot, and J.G. Goronzik, who participated in the riot. J.G. grew up to have a punk metal band of his own, Disciples of Dissent. As for that other kid, the one who peed on the plant, well, he grew up and got a job working for Washington State Fairies. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is getting there. This next story starts in a familiar situation, a young person unsure of what to do next. But that all changes when she happens upon an obscure printing press in Olympia and meets the woman who runs it. Sound Effect contributor Rob Smith brings us the story of a friendship that blossomed between the two, even as it moved implacably toward a final farewell.
Up a narrow, wooded driveway on the west side of Olympia, a teal cottage sits beneath a canopy of trees. Inside, light from the south pours in through a large window as Jamie Heinricher explains her work.
The only electrical thing on the press is the motor that drives the flywheel.
Steampunk Rube Goldberg device comes to mind. The machine is a Heidelberg printing press from 1950. We're at the Sherwood Press. How Jamie came to own this business is a story that she's told many times, but it can still move her to tears. It was 1989. Jamie was working at a coffee shop. She did calligraphy on the side, for weddings and such. Ink on paper. Maybe that's why a friend kept bugging her to check out this little print shop on the west side. Jamie kept putting it off until her friend just insisted. So finally she made an appointment, knocked on the door, and it opened.
And here's this crackling fire, and here's Jocelyn with her apron and her little bolo tie and all this printing equipment and clutter. And I just was instantly enchanted. We probably talked for like 2 hours, and she just was the person that I needed. Something about her and her open-mindedness and her contentedness with her craft. Everything about it, the ink, the type, the machines, and the sound of the machines, it just went straight in.
Jamie was 25. She had just discovered Jocelyn Dome and the Sherwood Press. This day would change her life.
I mean, I basically said, I'm gonna volunteer for you. And she didn't say no, so I would just keep coming back every week.
The two were instantly compatible. Jamie learned all about Jocelyn's life up to that point, like how she grew up in the house just down the hill. How as a kid, Jocelyn's family would put on Christmas caroling concerts and plays on a backyard stage. Jocelyn had gone to Olympia High School. She was gay and relatively out for the 1930s. After high school, Jocelyn went to the University of Washington. And 4 years later, she returned to Olympia with a degree in English and an idea for a printing press. Her dad helped her build this cottage on the hill, and the Sherwood Press was born. The business grew. By the mid-40s, Jocelyn was able to quit her day job. She developed a steady clientele, jobs of all sizes, from wedding announcements and political flyers, to the more mundane, like this placard that Jamie shows me. It says in large bold type, "This is our disposal unit."
This is our disposal unit.
No funeral, no service. So I guess it would go on the dumpster outside of probably Mills and Mills funeral home. And it's saying if you're not having a funeral, you can't use this dumpster.
Oh, okay.
Complete price $210 and cremation or cemetery charges, meaning like in case you're interested. Okay.
<That's> Jocelyn kept a copy of every print job she did. It adds up to a pretty impressive history of Olympia in the second half of the 20th century. By the time Jamie walked through the door of the Sherwood Press at age 25, Jocelyn was 70. She'd been running the business for nearly 50 years. Jamie says she knew within weeks that Jocelyn had a plan for the end of her life.
She wanted me to know that she believed in death with dignity. I didn't see how that would become such a central experience between us.
Vision loss and mobility issues began to keep Jocelyn from the work that defined her life. As Jocelyn's health declined, Jamie's responsibilities grew. And she worried what would happen in the coming years to her friend and to this place that she loved so much.
I remember it so well because I was terrified.
She had an idea, but had to be sure about it.
I was kind of like, well, I was wondering if I might be your successor. And I look over at her and she didn't say anything immediately, but she smiled and then she said, "That's what I've always wanted."
Jamie and Jocelyn would have 6 more years together. Jamie took on still more of the work as Jocelyn's health declined. All the while, Jocelyn kept dropping hints, like a booklet she left where Jamie was sure to see it. Instructions for how to end your own life using helium. She could also be more direct, like the time she was out with Jamie for a birthday lunch.
She looked across the table and she said, "I just want you to know, I would not be sorry to die." And I never heard that from anyone in my life.
This is where they left it. The topic of Jocelyn's death was just too uncomfortable for Jamie to pursue. But she sensed something coming. Jocelyn was losing her sight, losing her ability to get around. She was losing the ability to do the work that provided her a fulfilling life. In Jocelyn's final years, she did things to help Jamie and the Sherwood Press handle a transition of management, like going over the books and reviewing suppliers. In Jocelyn's final days, Jamie still wasn't able to talk to her friend about what she thought was imminent. Then one Friday, the messaging became very clear. Jamie told Jocelyn she was leaving early that day. She was getting lunch with a friend before picking up her son Parker.
She stood here and she said, "Well, you better give me a hug then." She had never asked me for a hug in 14 years. Never. We did hug regularly, but that was really stood out. And so I wasn't quite convinced of anything. So I left for lunch. And on the way walking from my car into the restaurant, I just started bawling my head off.
Over lunch, Jamie decided that she had to go back. She began helping Jocelyn set up things for the following week. When they couldn't find one of the scheduled jobs, Jamie suggested they'd just find it on Monday.
And she said, that's right, you'll find it on Monday. So I'm thinking, okay, we're not talking about this. And I think because she wasn't talking about it, I sort of felt like I needed to follow her lead. If she wasn't going to talk about it, I wasn't going to talk about it. 5 o'clock came around and we started locking up. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is her last time at the Sherwood Press. I felt like I was trespassing on this moment that was like so important, but it was also possibly my last moment with this woman that I cared about so much. My heart was racing. I had no time to reflect on, like, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go throw my arms around her and say, please don't do this? Or I love you? Or I felt like I was stuck in amber. But I walked her over to her car and she got in her van. And I, absurdly, I kind of looked through her open window and I said, well, I'll see you later. And as I was kind of pulling out, I saw her get out of her van and come back in the press. She probably needed to say goodbye to this place where she had spent 63 years in her work.
Jocelyn quietly ended her life at home that following Sunday in 2003. She was 85. 16 years after Jocelyn's death, Jamie still operates the Sherwood Press. She's added a couple machines to keep the business relevant. But one thing that hasn't changed is Jocelyn's old answering machine. Once in a while, when Jamie wants to hear her old friend, she pulls it out, plugs it in, and goes back in time.
This is the Sherwood Press, but the printers are out at the moment. Despite what the phone book says, we're still at 811 West 5th Avenue, and your message will be answered in a real live voice soon. Thanks.
That story from contributor Rob Smith. You can hear a longer version on Rob's podcast, Welcome to Olympia. We'll have a link on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is Getting There. Every year in the fall, Dr. Ron Nato makes a trip to Still Creek. He's a primary care doctor in Portland, and he heads to this creek in the shadow of Mount Hood to watch the salmon return to where they were born.
To see the salmon, they, as you may know, migrate up every 3 years. That's their lifespan. So they're out in the ocean for 3 years, and then they always return to within probably 100 yards of where they were born. And it's quite, you know, sort of a spiritual kind of thing, because that's where they die, and also new life is coming in the coming months.
This ancient dance of life and death, Ron Nato has drawn nourishment from it for years. But this year was different. It's probably the last time he'll see it. You see, Dr. Nato is dying. He has advanced pancreatic cancer. He recently stopped chemotherapy because it wasn't helping anymore, and he's getting palliative care at home. Ron Nato grew up in Portland in a prominent Japanese-American family.
I'm the middle of three sons, and we were raised to be Americans. We spoke no Japanese in the house. And, you know, being Japanese, of course, it was close enough to World War II. There was still anti-Japanese sentiment, and the way kids are, you know, I did get called a Jap and spit on, pushed down, and chased by bullies, things like that. But, you know, that's just something you have to overcome.
Dr. Nato became a primary care doctor because he genuinely wanted to help people. Dr. Nato practiced for almost 40 years, treating generations of Portland families. Then, in the summer of 2018, he started to suspect something was wrong.
I was having daily abdominal pain where I could only relieve it by sitting up, so I spent many nights sleeping sitting up in a chair.
It was time for the doctor to go see a doctor. And that led to a pivotal moment in this chapter of Dr. Nadeau's story. First, he had a blood test, and the results were sky high.
29,000, which is 1,000 times normal. And I told him, well, it looks like pancreatic cancer. And he said, no, it could be something else. When I knew there was almost zero chance it could be something else.
Besides being devastated by the news, he was annoyed at how it was delivered. His doctor was being really cagey. He saw another physician to have the tumor confirmed and sized, and this time he learned the bad news by overhearing a conversation his gastroenterologist had in the hallway.
You know, he walked by one direction saying 5 centimeters to the medical student. Then he was turning, walking the other way, said very bad, because with pancreatic cancer, a lot of the prognosis rests on size, and once you go above 3 or 3.5 centimeters, the prognosis is much worse.
But he didn't tell this to you?
No. And I had this eerie feeling like I was kind of divorced from all humankind. I was on a little island somewhere, and everybody else was on the mainland. I was on a little island or a boat adrift at sea, cut off from humanity now.
Dr. Nadeau doesn't know how much time he has left. But what's remarkable is how he has chosen to use this last chapter of his life to continue to help other people. He's devoting his last months to teaching medical students how to deliver bad news. It's for a class called Living with Life-Threatening Illness. He hopes the next generation of doctors will be able to guide patients through an overwhelming diagnosis with more candor and compassion. Ron Nadeau and I sit together in his home in Portland. Autumn light streams through the picture window as he talks about the journey he's been on for the last year. He tells me what, from his unique perch, he's been trying to communicate to the young doctors in training.
Well, as I mentioned, the chief thing I try to tell them is the absolute need to be fully present. I mean, I know we have these strictly defined boundaries, et cetera, doctor, patient, but when you're telling someone they have a terminal diagnosis, as I say, we're just two human beings facing an inevitable condition of being mortal. I tell them this to the patient is probably one of the most important moments of their lifetime. If they are one of these long-term survivors, they will remember that day. They will remember each word you spoke for years and years of the future. They will never forget the word, the phrase you used, if it was delivered in a clumsy or unfeeling way. They remember all of that. They remember all that more than anything else in the whole course of their illness. So it's vital that you do it right. And in order to know how to do it right, you would have to be able to hopefully know your patient from your previous experience and then be able to read the patient instantly as they're reacting and be able to change your words as you go. And so that requires complete presence.
What's wrong with denial? Denial served me well on a lot of occasions.
It serves everyone well. It's a safe place emotionally for you to remain, but then, unfortunately, if you remain in denial, you can't do the spiritual work you want to do. As I say, some people are in denial until the very last minute. For example, in the United States until recently, patients frequently got chemotherapy until 2 weeks before their death. And many patients believe, as long as I've been getting chemo, I can't die. Yet they are dying.
It strikes me that you are demonstrating that you can do a lot, grow a lot, accomplish a lot, even after you get a diagnosis like this.
Yes. Well, I know there many cases where after they're diagnosed, a transition or transformation happens even in a matter of days. The angry man is no longer angry. He comes to a sense of peace and acceptance. The way to do it is to let the patient know you have this serious, serious diagnosis, but, you know, I'm still your doctor. I'm with you. We're still a team, and I'm going to fight with you each step of the way and be there as a source of strength and counsel. Although your main treating doctor may be a cancer specialist, I'm still here. And so I've had several patients where they're seeing an oncologist, but they actually come still to see me. I'm doing nothing technically to help them at all, but they still need to see me. And I say, fine. If this is helping you, you're welcome to come and see me every month.
What you're talking about, it sounds like, is really maintaining a connection, a human connection.
When you're doing this difficult mission of telling the patient diagnosis, you have to go outside yourself, be fully present to the patient's needs, and try to get beyond your own emotional stress that you're feeling. Because I tell medical students, you know, one of you has a white coat, one of you is in the patient role, but basically we're just two human souls communicating.
Yeah. I wonder if that kind of connection might make a patient with that diagnosis feel less of the isolation, feel less like they're out on the island, and more like they're on land with everyone else.
I'm certain that would be true.
Dr. Nato says the last phase of our life can be the richest, if we allow it to be.
When we're busy in our normal lives, we don't appreciate all the love there is that is everywhere. It's limitless. And you learn also about self-love, because, you know, most of us have, to some degree, this harsh inner critic that drives us. And in the last 15 months, that I don't have a harsh inner critic anymore. The biggest writer on death and dying is named Stephen Levine. He's written 6-7 books on dying and grief. And he says you must have a death prayer. And it has to include the word surrender. So he says, for example, O Lord, I surrender. That's perfect, he says. That is not my death prayer. My death prayer is surrounded by love, I'm going home.
That's Dr. Ron Nato. To see him teach medical students about the importance of how they deliver difficult news, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Getting There. If life is a journey, then, well, you know the ultimate destination. And getting there, to the end of life, is often not pretty. The sheer physicality of aging and dying are things we try not to think about. So it's especially striking when these subjects turn up in an unexpected place. Say, your indie rock playlist. Carrie Goodwin plays bass for the Seattle-based band Great Grandpa. She also happens to be a nursing student. In her song Rosalie, Goodwin introduces us to someone who's losing her grip on life, and maybe gets us a little closer to wrapping our brains around our common fate. She caught up with sound effect contributor Allie Ferguson to dissect the song and talk about the intersection of nursing and art.
The path in her brain gets rewarded again, where it hardens and strengthens in a looping refrain.
So when I was in college working as a nursing assistant, I would get lots of different kinds of patients. A lot of them had dementia, and one patient I had whose name was not actually Rosalie, and I changed it for a HIPAA violation, but she was in her 80s and she had pretty advanced dementia to the point where her behavior was very strange, and I just found it really difficult to be with someone who didn't really seem like a person anymore but was still alive.
There's an endless expanding drawn in the eyes, a soul decomposing, a body alive.
One thing that I am very proud of about Rosalie is the song structure of how the story develops. You sort of get introduced to her in a very vague way in an introduction, and then the first verse you sort of see her as she is, and the second verse you see her as she was, and then the end is sort of trying to make sense of what's all happening. And it very much mirrored my experience of you first show up and you're sort of brought into this very strange world. It takes you a while to get comfortable with what they're doing and who they are and sort of what their reality is. And then your mind sort of wanders and you think about what they used to be, and then you leave and you have to make sense and integrate back into your own life and face your own future of uncertainty. One of the most interesting things is the line about cereal on the ceiling. I gave her a bowl of dry cereal as a snack, and so she was eating it, and then all of a sudden she just threw it against the wall and then looked at me very seriously and she's like, "I'm done." And it was just something, I mean, it was almost something that a toddler would do, and it just really took me off guard. And also it was so funny, and you know, you have a brief moment of humor in a really difficult day, and that was why that was inspired by.
Yeah, in dealing with people with dementia, there can be a lot of difficult and funny and strange moments all throughout the day. How do you deal with that as a caregiver? It's almost like you kind of have to adapt to their reality.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like your first instinct when somebody has dementia and expresses very strange concerns or fears is to try and reorient them, try to bring them back into your reality. But actually, it's much better to just sort of go with their reality. It creates less trauma for them to not have to constantly be yanked back in and out of their worlds. Rosalie in particular was very paranoid. She would often say things like, "Please don't hurt me." You know, and as a caregiver, you're like, "Well, I would never hurt you." And I don't know if anything had happened to her in her past that she had been hurt. I kind of suspect not. And paranoia is really common in that. But just that was hard as a caregiver to have someone fear you in that way and have it be totally unfounded in that case.
Rosalie lives on her own, scared like a German shepherd in the back of the yard.
Yeah, I guess the imagery is sort of like a dog that is alarming and protective and scared of something that doesn't really make sense. You know, it's sort of almost an instinct to be defensive, but you're being defensive by also being aggressive.
I feel like the song really builds, and then there's this anthemic release, especially vocally for Alex, the lead singer. Why did you make that choice in the songwriting?
After you spend an entire day with someone who has dementia, I would always leave those places and feel, because you almost feel like you get sort of stuck on their world and on their pace. Everything's slow, everything is very repetitive. And then I would sort of leave their house and just have this moment of freedom and like feeling being in a young body and sort of moving quickly. Sometimes I would even run or just like have this moment of, "I'm not there yet," you know, because I think a lot of it is when you're exposed to that all the time, you sort of feel like it's inevitable for yourself and you start reflecting a lot on your own mortality. And so I think the end of the song for me was a way to sort of break free from it a little bit and remember that we're still young and full of life.
The hardest part.
word relentless is so key in that, because there's no real recovery or healing for dementia. Why did you choose that word specifically?
I think a lot of it is that life just felt so unfair at times. That's sort of what relentless meant to me, is it just life kind of takes things from you one at a time, and that's one of the only things that's for sure in our life. And I think that was really hard for me to deal with. It still is. I haven't made a lot of progress there.
But now, I mean, you're going to be a nurse pretty soon, and now having this training, has that changed how you approach that or think about that at all?
Yeah, I've always had many fears, and I've also always really tried to confront my fears. So I think that's maybe why, as a child who was particularly afraid of death, I ended up focusing so much on care of the elderly. And now I've been around several people as they're passing, and I was getting very stuck on the relentless and, you know, fixed nature of that sort of thing. And I think I've only recently, through these experiences, learned to sort of reframe it a little bit. Like, yes, you can't help that this is happening, but that also gives you a lot of freedom in the way that you think about it. And you can think about death as being, you know, something that can be really beautiful. And I think it's only by being exposed to it over and over again and seeing the different kinds of ways that people can leave this world, and you realize that there are much better ways than others.
You don't see medicine necessarily represented in music a whole lot. What does it mean to you to have this outlet as you start your nursing career?
Nurses see so much tragic stuff every single day. It's just a part of the job, as you see people on the worst days of their lives. And so I think developing good ways to process and cope with that is really important for anyone who works in patient care, but especially nurses who are involved in the minutiae of these people's lives every single day. Most of us are drawn to this profession because we care about people and because we're empathetic people. But that can become a liability over time, because you absorb everyone's pain and then you sort of burn out. And I think that's very common. So I guess my goal is hopefully that I can use music or other forms of creativity as a way to process it, make some sense out of it, and maybe make something beautiful out of it. I guess I just have to make sure that I don't write too many sad songs about my patients.
That story was produced by sound effect contributor Allie Ferguson. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Rob Smith, Allie Ferguson, Max Wasserman, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploke. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Hear Sound Effect anytime when you subscribe to our podcast. And it sounds even better when you rate and review it. I'm sure it does. Find us on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, or wherever you get your audio. And you can summon us right out of your smart speaker. Just say, play the podcast Sound Effect. Meet you back here next week when our theme is Hidden Talents. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.